between Christianity and it. One of the problems, though, I would see, if I can make this point about pantheism, Christianity says that that ultimately reality, that which is real, is one and many. That basically, reality, there is one God, and He created many things and many beings. Okay? So the plurality that we see, when I communicate with you, there is real communication going on between two entities, okay? Whereas within the pantheistic worldview, at least the purer forms of pantheism, all plurality is an illusion. So when your New Age friend tries to convince you to become a pantheist, it is one being trying to convince another being that there is only one being. It is one mind trying to convince another mind that only one mind exists. So what I'm basically saying, the defense of pantheism is actually a refutation of pantheism, because just the fact that one mind tries to convince another mind that there's no distinction between those two minds, to me, at least, it implies that there is a distinction between the two minds. Otherwise, one mind wouldn't have to convince the other mind, because they would be the same mind. But whatever the case, and then I think it's not livable, there really is a difference between good and evil. There really is a difference between helping grandma across the street and setting her on fire. And in our generation, both have been done numerous times. And I would like to see the guys who set grandma on fire at least put away from the rest of us, so that we would not have to fear coming in the company of this young gentleman. But whatever the case, the distinction there between pantheism and theism. By the way, Spinoza, he came at a time, the time of right around the same time as Descartes, and they were really getting heavy into geometry, and they were looking at everything, they were trying to prove everything, a geometric proof, a proof in geometry brings with it, it's a deduction, it brings with it certain conclusions, and this was the start of what is called modernism, the attempt through human reason to prove basically everything with absolute certainty. And from that kind of thinking, Spinoza reasoned that God could not perform miracles because God was not a personal being who freely chose to set the laws of nature in motion, like the law of gravity, the first and second laws of thermodynamics, things like that. But instead, they were the natural outworkings of God. It wasn't his choice. It had to be that way. So in his way of thinking, there was no way God could supersede those laws and perform miracles. So he also is famous for arguing against miracles. Let me talk real briefly about dualism. Let me see that marker. I mean the eraser. First off, there's several different kinds of dualism. There's a worldview, metaphysical, it goes beyond the physical world and it tries to talk about, well, what's this world all about? What is reality ultimately? So one type of metaphysical dualism is the belief that there are two gods, a good god and a bad god. Zoroastrianism is still a modern world religion, only 100,000 adherents worldwide. And they still believe in dualism, two gods, an all-good god and an all-evil god. Not a very popular view. Another type of dualism is called epistemological.
This is an important word. Dualism. You want to know about this.
Yeah, epistemology, basically, epistemology deals with philosophy of knowledge. Is there such a thing as truth? Can man know it? How does man know the truth? What can man know? Can he know it with certainty or only with a high degree of probability? All those are epistemological issues. Well, in epistemological dualism, what we're basically saying is there is a real distinction between the knower and that which is known. In other words, there is a distinction between Phil Fernandez, the knower, and the desk that he has knowledge of. Because there are some philosophers who argue that there isn't a distinction between the two. A real hyper-idealist who views everything as ideas would hold to solipsism, which basically would believe that the whole universe exists in my mind.
Could you put that term on the board, please?
Yes.
You're going to encounter this in the reading if you haven't already, so maybe you could run by that again.
Sure. It's basically the view that ultimately there's so much emphasis on the subjective, your inward ideas, and such a de-emphasis on what the real world outside your mind, that there really is no real world outside your mind. Everything exists in your mind. Okay? So it's kind of like if your brother, if you hold to that view and your brother stole your car from you and totaled it, you'd be inconsistent with your worldview to get mad at him, because in reality he doesn't exist. He only exists in your mind. And I'm sure a lot of us, if our brothers did that, we would hope that he really did only exist in our minds, but I think that it self-destructs. We can't live that way. But whatever the case, that's the second kind of dualism, a distinction between the knower and that which is known. But another kind is also a metaphysical dualism. It's the mind-body dualism. And I think that's the one that your instructor would like me to kind of focus on, the mind-body dualism. Is man just a body, or is he more than a body? Do we have an immaterial mind, okay? Or do we just do all our thinking with our brains? It's making a comeback now, but in modern times, this is once man rejected the God of the Bible and took on more of an atheistic or at least an agnostic, but atheism teaches that there is no God. Agnosticism teaches that there's no evidence that there's a God, so a strong form of agnosticism, we should, for all practical purposes, live like atheists. There's always a possibility that maybe God does exist, but there's no evidence of it. But whatever the case, once we threw God out the window in Western culture, it only makes sense to throw the mind out the window too. So for the most part, and this isn't across the boards, for the most part, the view called physicalism, that all that exists is physical, and there might be some non-physical effects from the physical. I think it begs the question, though. But basically, physicalism became popular, that everything that exists is physical. It also was referred to as materialism. That was the way we used to refer to it. Everything that exists is matter. Now, there are some atheists who do believe that there are immaterial realities and there are also physical realities. And the immaterial realities, like the laws of mathematics and numbers and things like that, they really do exist, but they're just the furniture of the universe. I think that begs the question. If you throw out God because you can't see him, but you hold to all these non-physical realities, but it just comes as the furniture of the universe, I think atheism fails to supply an adequate explanation for it. And I would argue that non-material entities really doesn't make sense in an atheistic worldview, and we would need something along the line. In fact, if I was going to put more emphasis on either the mind or the body, since modern science has shown that the physical realm, the material realm, the closer we examine this solid desk, the less solid it appears, the more empty space we find. So it looks real solid to us. You put it under a microscope, there's a lot of empty space. So I would argue that I hold to both mind and body, immaterial and material, but if I was going to favor one over the other, I would probably favor the mind, the immaterial aspect, And in fact, now we like to talk about matter as energy, because all matter is energy in motion. Okay? So, if anything, with modern science, and by the way, that is the case right now, modern science is moving away from atheism more towards a pantheistic, at least modern, I should say modern scientists are now starting to entertain more of a spiritual view of the world, a spiritual view that I would not adhere to myself. So I think both the atheist and the Christian camps are upset on what's going on in modern science today, but the speculation is heading in a different direction. But I would argue that as evidence for the existence of the immaterial mind, that there are non-physical entities that exist. And we can deny the existence of these non-physical entities, but as we deny them, we still live like these non-physical entities really do exist. I'll give you an example of a few of them. Numbers. Now, by the way, probably throughout the history of philosophy, probably the greatest philosophers that have ever lived, a high majority of them believed in some type of God and did believe in the spiritual realm until recently. I'm talking like the last couple hundred years. The last 200 years, then things began to shift. But probably the most famous guy that would hold to these non-physical entities that exist would be Plato. He basically held that there was a world of forms or a world of ideas. In other words, this physical chair does exist, but the reason why we call it a chair is because it's a particular chair that fits in a universal set called chairs. Okay, and this universal set, the reason why a chair is a chair, because it shares the chairness that all chairs have. Okay, it's the same with a dog. We recognize a dog as a dog because he contains dogness. I mean, it is sometimes it's hard to explain what exactly dogness is, what exactly chairness is, because we might define a chair as a four-legged thing that you sit on. Well, there are some chairs that are only three-legged that you sit on. And well, what if you break a leg off a chair? It's still a chair. It's a broken chair, but it's still a chair. We define humans as having two arms. Well, what if somebody loses their arm in an automobile accident? They're still a human. So you have to make a differentiation between essential properties, the properties that are necessary to be a member of the set, and non-essential properties. So that a human doesn't have two arms to be a human, but a human does have to have some things to be a human, and philosophers debate exactly what that might be. But whatever the case, Plato argued that there are eternal, unchanging ideas, invisible, immaterial ideas that exist. Now, Augustine was very influenced by Plato, came about 600 years later. When Augustine became a Christian, he acknowledged the existence of these eternal, unchanging ideas, but he said that they exist in the mind of God. Okay? He argued that ideas don't make any sense unless the ideas are the product of a mind. And so God eternally produces these eternal, unchanging ideas. But whatever the case, one of those ideas would be, you know, 1 plus 1 equals 2. Oops. 1 plus 1 equals 2. There are lots of people that argue that mathematics is just a game we play. Okay? And that it's possible that 2 billion years ago, 1 plus 1 didn't equal 2. And it's possible that 10 years from now, 1 plus 1 might not equal 2. I totally disagree. I think 1 plus 1, by definition, equals 2. And I think it's more than just a language game. If numbers are not real, then it's hard for me to understand that they would, it's hard for me to accept that they would tell us something about reality. Okay? Yeah?
How about the view that numbers are just a system that we use to organize material?
Yeah, and that's probably the more popular view today. Platonism is not, Plato's still well respected, but that's probably, even among Christian thinkers, numbers are not widely accepted. William Lane Craig, a good friend of mine, probably the best evangelical philosopher alive today, he denies the actual existence of numbers. But J.P. Moreland, who I think has done more research on that particular issue, he holds to the real existence of numbers, and I would agree with him. Now, regardless of where a person stands on numbers, I think there are other things that we can argue for, and I'll bring them up too. But if numbers do not exist, then I think it's tough to make a case that mathematics give us a real knowledge about the world. I mean, what if philosophers, I mean, whether you're talking Newtonian physics or Einstein's theories of relativity, which superseded Newtonian physics, you're talking a whole lot of mathematics, which are supposed to reveal to us truth about the universe in which we live. Now, two things. Number one, well, if the math is just an internally consistent game, does it really give us information about the world in which we live? And if it doesn't, let's stop paying these scientists a high salary, because they're just, it's just a big game that they're doing. They're not really telling us any truths about the world in which we live. But number two, and now I'm starting to get another brain cramp here, or I should say a mind cramp, really, but whatever the case, numbers, space to, if I remember it, I'll come back to it. Another non-physical group of entities would be moral values. Now, a lot of people say, no, moral values are invented by individuals. Each individual decides what is right for his own eyes. My argument would be, well, if that's the case, if moral values come from each individual person, then one individual cannot condemn the actions of another individual as wrong. And then, so you wouldn't be able to call Adolf Hitler's actions wrong. So other people say, well, maybe it's a society that decides what is right and what is wrong. Problem with that, then one society can't call the actions of another society wrong. I.e., America and the Allies can't call the actions of Nazi Germany wrong. So others would say, well, maybe it's a world consensus. Yeah, but the world consensus has been wrong in the past. We used to think that the sun revolved around the earth, not the other way around. The world consensus used to be that slavery, there's nothing wrong with slavery. Okay? The whole idea of human world progress, okay, which both Christians and non-Christians, atheists included, they fight for world progress, they're implying that there are some, whether they believe it or not, they're implying there are some eternal, unchanging moral standards that the world was doing worse on those standards years ago, and now we can move the world in the right direction. We can progress and move closer and closer to the idea of perfection. Okay? So the whole idea of moral progress assumes the existence of eternal, unchanging, timeless, if you will, moral values. But I'll throw out one that I think is a moral value. I think it's wrong for everybody, everywhere, at any time. Torturing innocent babies. Now, there are people, Bertrand Russell, his view was that when we say killing is wrong, we're just expressing our own emotions. But we're not really saying something that's objectively real, apart from what humans think. I would disagree. I think that torturing, and I don't even think Russell did not live that way, by the way. He acted like moral values are just with people expressing their emotions, but then he protested World War I. He led protests in favor of homosexual rights, all sorts of things that he stood for because he believed that they were right, when in actuality he said that really there's no such thing as right and wrong. All we are doing is expressing our emotions, which, by the way, you also find in his Why I'm Not a Christian. But I believe torturing innocent babies is wrong today. It's going to be wrong 100 years from now. It was wrong throughout the entire history of mankind. And so I would see that as an eternal, unchanging moral value. Now, when atheists debate me on this topic and don't want to hold to those moral values, I basically say, well, if I've got a worldview that can call torturing innocent human babies wrong for all people at all times in all places, then I think my worldview is better than yours. And if you don't think yours is, and you can live with the possibility of torturing innocent babies being okay, then, you know, more power to you, whatever. But in actuality, I would disagree with that. There are atheists that do hold absolute moral values. The problem is, it just doesn't make sense to me, in a world that's totally explained by physical causes, why there would be non-physical entities such as moral values. Truth. Oh boy, this, basically absolute truth must exist. You can try to deny, for somebody to say there are no absolute truths, but absolute truth to mean a universal truth that is true for all people at all times. To say there are no absolute truths, if that is true, it would be an absolute truth. So it's basically, it's a self-refuting statement, okay? People say, well, you know, the problem is just semantical, we can't communicate without the idea of antithesis, or the law of non-contradiction, A cannot be equal non-A at the same time in the same way. We have to communicate as if there is such a thing as true, but in actuality it doesn't exist. No, it goes further back than that, we can't even think unless, whether consciously or unconsciously, we presuppose the concept of absolute truth. Okay? We have to think in terms of truth and falsity, not just express ourselves. And some would say, well, that's just the problem with humans. I think it goes beyond, you know, I think it just comes down to that absolute truth. You know, and people can deny it, but I think they don't have a leg to stand on. Ideas, thoughts, theories. Here's some questions. How much does a thought weigh? Okay, if physicalism is true, if all that exists is physical, if we're just bodies and we don't have minds, how much does a thought weigh? What color is it? Is it something that you can bounce? Okay, these are all nonsense questions. Why? Because physical attributes do not apply to the thought world. And therefore, I think we have good evidence that it doesn't apply to the mind. Now, I do think the mind, the immaterial mind, acts upon the brain. But by the way, we're also getting empirical evidence for this now. Scientists have prodded the human brain, and they've gotten people to lift their arms. And so they ask the people, okay, and then these, by the way, we're physicalists who were performing these experiments. They're documented in Gary Habermas and J.P. Moreland's book, Immortality, the Other Side of Death. They prodded the human brain, they've gotten people to raise their right hands, okay? And then they've asked them, okay, what happened? And they've responded without fail, you raised my right hand, okay? And by the way, this is the part of the brain that experiences the thing called pain, so you don't have to use anesthetic and that type of thing to prod this part of the brain. Whatever the case, the physicalists, the scientists, were shocked because they thought the people were going to say, I decided to lift my arm, and I lifted my arm. Because they figured you do the right chemical reaction in the brain, you push the right buttons, and it's going to cause them to decide to raise their arm. But what the people are saying is, I never made a decision. You did something, and it happened. And what it basically looks like, it appears to be evidence that the decisions are made somewhere outside the brain, and then that decision acts upon the brain, which then causes the arm to raise. But whatever the case, those experiments did not go the way the scientists wanted it to. The laws of logic, I don't have time to get into them, but the laws of non-contradiction, things like that, non-physical entities, universals. You have particulars, a particular chair, but the universal chair, the idea of chair, a universal is a real entity that can be in more than one place at the same time. For instance, some types of universals are called properties, redness, hardness. You can have a band that is red. You can have a shirt that is red. You can have a ball that is red. Yet, it's the same red. You know, it might be different shades of redness. But even if you went to a particular shade of redness, it's a universal that can exist in different places at different times. So it's not a particular. The concept red isn't something that you can bounce, that you can throw. Now, things that are red, you can do that. But the universal concept redness is not something. Even relations like larger than, we know that Joe Schmo is larger than his little brother Harry Schmo, okay? He's larger than him. Well, is larger than, is that relation, is that something that really is expressing a reality? Even the whole idea of equal, two things being equal, I would even argue that we don't get our concept of equality from looking at two equal things. We bring that concept in our heads, and this is why I'm not Thomistic in my thought. I think that Plato is right. We start life with innate ideas that we're not aware of until we work them out. But I don't want to spend too much more time on this, but basically love. I really do not believe you can find a place in your body that is where love comes from. Okay? I don't believe you can take love and bounce it. I don't believe that you can weigh love. At the same time, when a husband tells his wife, I love you, I believe he's talking about a reality. A real emotion, maybe even a real choice that he makes to seek the greatest good of his mate. So basically what I'm saying, I believe love is real, but it's invisible, it's immaterial. Same can be said for joy, patience, things of that sort. But basically a physicalist or materialist view cannot adequately explain the existence of these non-physical entities. Even a scientist who says that truth can only be found through the five senses and denies these non-physical entities, still, he tries to be honest with his experiments and to bring out conclusions. The fact of the matter is, you can't put honesty in a test tube. You can't weigh it. You can't measure it. And so even the guys that deny non-physical entities seem to use these non-physical entities.
So, just to clear it up, if every human being in the universe died for some reason, then love would still exist.
Yeah, I believe
because
so.
Because it is not something that is just, say, a linguistic convenience used to label a set of feelings that you may have brought from the universe.
I believe that is the case. But again, I believe in the existence of an eternal God. I believe in a spirit realm and that type of thing. But those who would just try to make love something of either a human invention or some of the package that necessarily comes with what a human is, I think basically what I think is that the atheistic evolutionist, the pure materialist, is borrowing some of the capital from the Christian worldview. In other words, they didn't take Nietzsche seriously enough. So even though they reject the God of the Bible, they still resurrect Christian values and Christian ideas whenever they need them, or at least what I would call theistic. It's not another word now. Theistic ideas.
You're just looking at human experience, not denying that.
But I would argue though, when you look at human experience, and even the concept experience itself, in other words, like for instance, on moral values. If there are no moral values, then whatever is. No such thing as right and wrong. But if there are moral values, then beyond what is, there is also the ideal, the way things ought to be. And in a purely materialistic world, there is no room for oughtness. There's no room for the way things ought to be. All you have is whatever is. Yet at the same time, scientists are always leading the way. This is the way things should be. You know, it's just like a guy told me once that a particular practice in this country is, since there's no such thing as right and wrong, no one should force people not to do this particular thing. So he said, no such thing as right and wrong, therefore no one should. He's saying it's wrong to deny, since there's no such thing as right and wrong, it's wrong to deny a person any action they feel like doing. It's just contradictory. I don't really have time to get into Leibniz, other than Leibniz came from a Christian worldview, but he was not real consistent with his Christian worldview. And so I would disagree with him on a lot of points. But basically, the incarnation was a question that that was brought up. Basically, what Christianity teaches is that Jesus, and this is going to sound far-fetched to people who don't come from the Christian worldview, but I think it is very consistent within the Christian worldview, so other evidence that would defend Christianity would also go a long way to defend the idea of the Trinity. But the scriptures teach that Jesus is God, the second person of the Trinity. And God basically is three eternal persons. Now, if a single-celled animal had understanding, a single-celled animal would say, look, I'm one cell and I'm one being, and Phil Fernandez is millions of cells, he must be millions of beings, okay? Well, if a single-celled animal was able to think and came up with that conclusion, the single-celled animal would be wrong. Because I exist on a higher dimension, if you will, than a single-celled animal. Well, I think it's the same way with God. If Christianity is true, then God is one being, but somehow three persons. And since we're one being and one person, we often try to drag God down to our level, but the fact of the matter is, as we exist on a higher level than a single-celled animal, God exists on a higher level than we do. In fact, his existence is infinite, unlimited existence. We have finite existence. But basically, Christianity teaches that Jesus is God, the second person of the Trinity. He existed as God throughout all eternity, so that he has an infinite nature, an unlimited nature as God. He is fully God. But that, as fully God and as the creator of this universe, and he didn't have to create this universe, Spinoza would disagree, but he didn't have to create this universe, he freely chose to create it, and he freely chose to create it, and therefore he is also interested in this creation. And so this infinite God chose to reveal himself through his creation, through miracles and all, but the ultimate fulfillment was when the infinite God, God, the second person of the Trinity, added a finite human nature. A finite human nature. So not only is he still fully God, but he is also fully man. And then at particular times in the New Testament, by becoming man, during his time on earth, he chose not to tap into the divine powers that he had. He chose to rely on God the Father to reveal things to him and to lead him and to guide him. And so he could speak from his finite nature. And the scriptures could talk about him growing in wisdom and knowledge in his finite, limited nature. So it's not saying that Jesus is both infinite and finite in the same way at the same time. It's saying that he is infinite in his divine nature and he is finite in his human nature. Now let me say this, it might sound far-fetched that God could become a man. However, if God could create the universe, then it would seem to me that he would have no problem adding a human nature and becoming a man if he chose to do so. So I think that Christianity is internally consistent, and I think that we can argue for the truths of Christianity through other means, which this would basically, the doctrine of the Trinity and the Incarnation would be a logical conclusion to some of that argumentation. But there you're talking about something which goes, it's kind of on the further end of Christianity, that first you would have to argue for things that could be revealed by God in nature before you get to things that are revealed by God only in his word, okay, and in history. But whatever the case, I believe that's all I have time for, so maybe over to 10 more minutes of questions.
No.
So if you have any questions about what I said, philosophy is a lot, and I'm sure your instructor is seeing this lived out, embodied every time he gets up here to teach. It's kind of like learning another language, okay? The first philosophy book that I ever read, I had to read it over again four or five times because it was just new, not only new words, I mean, the first time I heard existentialism, they defined it as existence precedes essence. So I got it right on the test, but it took me about 2 years before I understood what existence preceding essence actually meant. Basically, what it amounts to is that throughout the history of philosophy, it was the idea that essence, man comes into the world with a defined nature, with parameters, and basically humans come into life already defined, and then we exist within that definition. Okay? Existence preceding essence, existentialism says, no, we come into existence without a definition, so we are free to actualize our own existence and make ourselves whoever we want to be. It takes the idea of free will to an ultimate extreme, to where Jean-Paul Sartre could say that it makes no difference whether you help an old lady across the street or mug her and take her purse. All that matters really is the fact that you actualized yourself, you gave meaning to your life. And so we come into existence without any real meaning, and it's up to us to make meaning for our lives through a leap of blind faith into the non-rational realm. But basically, that's what philosophy, you're talking about thousands of years of thought. Actually, most philosophers would say about 1,500 years of thought. I think it goes back further than that, though. And with each philosopher, that's another problem, is Hegel will use the same terms as some other philosopher, but he will define them totally differently. So it's like learning a new language. You gotta study it until eventually you just kind of get a feel for it. And even then, just when you think you know everything you need to know, some new philosopher comes on the scene, you can't make heads or tails out of it.
And why bother, though? What's the importance? Why even waste time with this pursuit?
I would say if ultimate truth does exist, then it's worthwhile. But for those philosophers like Nietzsche who deny the existence of ultimate truth, I would say, why bother? In fact, Albert Camus, also a French existentialist, was a buddy of Jean-Paul Sartre. He actually argued that because he didn't believe in God's existence and believed that life is without meaning, he basically said, well, why take the leap of blind faith like Sartre is saying? The only question philosophy has to answer is, why not suicide? And so I would basically say philosophy is a waste of time. In other words, if philosophy is the pursuit of wisdom and the pursuit of truth, if philosophy is the pursuit of a treasure chest of gold, if the treasure chest really doesn't exist, then I think philosophy is a waste of time. But if it does exist, then it's worthwhile for us to go on looking. And when you look at the history of philosophy, when Christianity came on the scene, you had a lot of speculation that Greek philosophers, which the leading Greek philosophers, the Aristotles, the Platos, the Socrates, acknowledged, and Plotinus acknowledged the existence of the spiritual realm, and they argued for it, and the Western world was right. And then when the Christian revelation came about, it gained wide acceptance, and I think Christianity then took philosophy, and I think took it to a higher degree. Others would say they perverted it or corrupted it, but I think eventually we reached a point where Western culture no longer wanted to bow before the God of the Bible, and started to do everything possible to move in the other direction. And that's where we find ourselves today. So basically, today it's radical to be a Christian. 300 years ago, you were radical if you tried to say something that people thought the Bible taught, other than that. But whatever the case, if there is really such a thing as truth out there, philosophy makes sense. It is worthwhile. But like the Apostle Paul said, if the dead are not raised, if there isn't a God, if there isn't life after death, if the dead are not raised, let us eat and drink, for tomorrow we die. And basically, he was quoting from a Greek philosopher at that particular point, the Greek poet that wrote hundreds of years before him. But I accept that as truth, that if there is no real ultimate meaning and no eternal value to human life, and no objective, absolute truth that is out there, then yeah, it is just a big, like Gordon Clark called, the big merry-go-round, a big cruel joke, and we're spending all this time and hard thinking when in actuality, you know, we're searching for something that isn't there. Well, Christianity teaches not only is it there, but his name is Jesus, and he said, I am the way, the truth, and the life. No one comes to the Father through me. And I spent 21 years butting my head with the King of Kings, and then I bowed before him. And a lot of my friends, you know, I used to, you know, hang out with the kind of guys who like to start a lot of trouble and stuff back in Jersey and all, but a lot of my friends probably think I committed intellectual suicide and made a jackass out of myself and lived a boring life. But I lived 21 years butting heads with Jesus, and 17 years now bowing before him. And I really believe that I'm experiencing true joy, something that that I never experienced my first 21 years of life. Now, you know, it could be that I'm deluded, I don't know, but I'm sure having a good time.
Totally unrelated, but I was just wondering, as we talked about this and as we've been studying, I've really noticed that a lot of the stuff that people are coming up with, the philosophers have come up with, are like these new, like how to be better, how to better our civilization, how to better man. But then when you look at who's really applied it, we always talk about the Nazis, we always talk about all the terrible things that they've done and how they're saying, well, this is, you know, they're taking what other philosophers have said and are applying it, and it turns out to be this really bad thing.
Yeah, there's two things. They call it utopia. Man's search for utopia, man's search for the perfect society, man trying to bring world peace and a perfect government on earth and that type of thing. If Christianity is true, we can't get it without the Prince of Peace, the Lord Jesus himself coming back and bringing it for us, because at our hearts, at our core, we are evil, we are sinful, we are fallen. We need to be redeemed and transformed by the Lord. But when the world throws out the God of the Bible, two things I can say about that. Number one, why try to make the world better if there's no such thing as good? Then there's no idea of perfection, and so the whole concept of perfectibility is nonsense. But number two, all the proposals that have been made always ends up being a few people, the intellectual elite, trying to force their views on the multitudes. And so you have Karl Marx promising a classless society, but when you iron out his views, you always end up with a big, ugly government. It takes away people's right to private property, takes away their freedoms, takes away the freedom to dream someday about owning your own business and owning your own land and that type of thing. And then you look at the communist leaders and they're all living in mansions. So the French Revolution was another attempt to attain a humanly attained perfect society, utopian view. There, I think when man tries to, I'm not saying we should try to do good for a fellow man, but I do think that there's some wishful thinking that is there. And even if you don't look at the Bible, you just look at the history of mankind, utopian dreams, when they're implemented, turn out to, in the end, you end up with nothing but genocide. And I'm not saying there's easy solutions, but I'm saying that the ultimate solution, you need more than man. The goodness is just not there. It's like our founding father said, power corrupts, and absolute power corrupts absolutely. And I think even a patriotic guy like me has to admit that you can even see that principle play out even in the lives of our founding fathers, who could say all men are created equal, but then many of them continue to enslave some people. Basically, there's this thing called power, that if we humans get too much of it, even nice humans can turn out to be not so nice and abuse that power and on other people. And it seems that utopian dreams have always gone that way, and I believe they will always go that way, with the one exception that when the God-man, the Lord Jesus, the King of Kings, returns, then he'll usher in the kingdom of God and righteousness. Now, again, that's way down the line in the Christian worldview. We're talking about philosophical principles that kind of lead up to it. But that idea that the human, the perfectibility of man, I think, really makes no sense in a godless universe, and makes no sense in a universe without moral values. There's no such thing as good, and there's no such thing as getting better. Anybody else have any questions?
All right.
Hey, what about a minute early?
Well, we have a couple of girls that are going to give a presentation following this, and I'm sure they need some time to get ready. And I'm sure everybody's pretty overloaded. This is heavy going. I'm glad that Dr. Fernandez came in and kind of reinforce the idea that I've been trying to communicate just how difficult these ideas are, so, I mean, as you all well know. And I'm glad, too, that he kind of projected into the future. He talked about Nietzsche, whom we're going to talk about, if not next week, the following week. And I'm hoping that we'll be able to finish with Karl Marx, because in the summer semester, we're going to talk about economic systems, and we're going to focus heavily on Marx and the economics of it, but we can't understand Marx if we don't understand the philosophical background. And so I'm glad you kind of set us up for that a little bit, too. Give these things some thought and be prepared to come in next week, and maybe, you know, it takes time to assimilate. You have to think about these things. And then next week we'll have a little discussion before we get into the reading.
If I could say one more thing, I almost forgot, but I recently authored a book, The God Who Sits Enthroned, Evidence for God's Existence. If you guys, when I go and give talks and stuff, I just give them away for nothing. There's an address there. If you want to send a donation to the Institute, that's fine, but that's not, you don't have to do that. So if you want that book to look at philosophical arguments for God's existence, even if you don't believe in God's existence, at least you'll see how philosophers on both sides of the issues throughout history lined up on it. And so I bring out a lot of different thoughts and ideas of philosophers, many of the philosophers that we mentioned today, plus numerous other philosophers. So if you want to just take a free one on your way out, we'll go right ahead. And in fact, I think I brought 19 of them, so I think there's enough for everybody.
These are the same kids you talked to last summer, the anthropology group.
Okay.
So some of them probably already have that.
If you already have it, but you paid for it the last time, if you want to take a free one to give to a friend or a free one to give to a relative, go right ahead. I feel bad that the last class they had to pay. So.
Okay, let's take a break. Kind of gather our wits, and then we'll come back.